Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is Service Governance with WebSphere Service Registry and Repository. The session is scheduled to be an hour in length, but might extend to an hour and a half for the presentation and for the Q&A period. Today's presenter is Laura Olsen. Laura is an expert in SOA governance. As an IBM certified consulting IT specialist, she has in-depth knowledge of SOA governance and has architected and developed numerous SOA solutions involving federation of registries, increasing agility of the ESB, and policy enforcement in heterogeneous environments. She has in-depth knowledge of the competitors in the SOA governance space, such as HP, Software AG, SOA Software, and Oracle. Laura has multiple articles on SOA published on DeveloperWorks and is also the co-author of multiple IBM Web Books, which is a technical publication that outlines best practices for designing and developing SOA solutions. At this point in time, I would like to pass the presentation over to Laura.
Thank you, Joseph. If you want to move to the slide 2, I believe. Okay, so the agenda for today is we're going to start off discussing with a brief, very brief introduction of the difference between SOA governance and service governance. And then we're going to have an introduction of the elements of a SOA platform, very brief, because I really want to set the context and what things that you may want to consider around service governance in order to grow your SOA platform. So you really need to understand the whole landscape of where the WSRR can play, okay? And then what we're going to do is we're going to spend a bulk of the time on discussing the elements of the governance enablement profile, which is a profile that is shipped out of the box with WSR that gives a prescriptive approach to service lifecycle governance. Okay? So let's move to slide 3. Okay. So what's SOA governance, what's service governance, and what's SOA management? You can think of SOA governance as the governance, it provides the overall approach and organization. This is where you really devise and set up your organizational changes, set up the roles and responsibilities of who's doing what, set up what's important for service governance and what is important for service management. So you can think of service management and service governance really as you know, subsets of SOA governance. Now, service governance focuses on the overall life cycle. Well, how do you propose a service to, all the way through, deployment of the service and eventual retiring and decommissioning of the service, okay? SOA management takes a look at the operations of the SOAs. How are the policies being enforced? Are they working well for you? And so forth. So all of these things have an overlap. SOA management has an overlap with SOA governance. There's things there's things that overlap, right? And it's important to understand. So it's important to understand all of the capabilities under the SOA governance umbrella. Today we're going to be focusing mostly on the service governance aspect. Now let's move to slide 4. I like to talk to slide 4 because it really gives you an end-to-end of what you need for service governance, okay? The top bubble that you see there, it deals with design time governance, and typically this is a registry repository, and you store things here like the services life cycle, the physical artifacts, service artifacts such as WSDLs, schema files, WS policies, and things that all relate to this service. What makes up a service version, which we will get into today? And the products that IBM has in this space is WSR Advanced Lifecycle Edition that branches all the way into the development lifecycle, storing development artifacts, and WSR, which is part of WSR ALE, which is dealing with operations and how it relates with the runtime. Okay. Now let's move over to the runtime and the policy enforcement portion. The runtime, you can basically consider it your ESB, your proxy, your it's your enforcement point. And this runtime really needs a view into that registry repository in order to get things like endpoint information, to get the policies which are supposed to be applied to the services, and any other type of configuration information, metadata information that drives around that service mediation. It's important that your runtime has this integration for multitudes of reasons, right? It increases your agility. You can react faster by changing a configuration or a policy than if you had to go and redeploy and hard code those configurations somewhere. And having those configurations in the registry repository really gives you the governance and control over that runtime. Whereas if you're storing those configurations in a file somewhere, there's really not a lot of control or governance around that. The most important, personally, I think, is besides the agility, is the reduction in operational costs and changes. Anytime you need to go and redeploy a mediation or change the mediation, it's an expensive endeavor and quite a more risky endeavor as well. And so these two, the runtime and the registry repository, really works in concert. And we're going to see that today and how that works as far as the WSR governance enablement profile. The third important component of an end-to-end service governance solution is a runtime management system. And what for IBM, we typically have IT Camp or SOA here. Well, that is important because it monitors the runtime, it monitors the service endpoint, and captures that information and puts it back into the registry repository. And that's important because you can get a holistic view, generate BERT reports to really start championing and understanding your SOA. You can also leverage this runtime metrics, the gathered metrics, by your runtime because to make intelligent decisions because the runtime has such tight integration with the registry repository. So when you have all of these three components and they're closely integrated and interoperate with each other, that's where you really get the SOA visibility. And the model, the governance enablement profile model that comes with out of the box with WSR, really helps facilitate this SOA visibility and ensure that we can get this closed-loop governance. We can move on to slide 5. Okay, so WSR, for the folks on there, I'm going to give a quick overview here, becomes your enterprise SOA registry repository, providing highly prescriptive service lifecycle governance, okay? It allows you to manage not only your service consumer, but your service provider and the contracts between those two that you can help optimize your resources and by reducing costs for the developing of those services and provisioning those services and so forth. The other thing it does I like to always highlight is that while we go through this profile, it's tailorable. Not everybody is going to use the same life cycles. And it's going to be pretty close, and I'll get into that as well. But WSR allows you to tailor the life cycles, creating the reports that are needed to champion your SOA and report back to your management team, your executives, on the health and the benefits and how well your service is performing. That's extremely important. The other thing I like to point out is the service discovery across heterogeneous environments. A lot of the customers I'm seeing now, they've started on SOA, but they didn't have governance in place right away. So they really don't have a good handle on what services they have out deployed in their environments today. So WSR has a service discovery module that works with JBoss, CEA, .NET, Oracle, and WebSphere to go out and find the services that are deployed out there, bring them into the registry so that you can start performing some of the governance and start collecting an inventory of what you have and getting organized. We also provide an extension API, so if one of the systems that, if you have a different app server, a homegrown app server, you can extend the API and create your own discovery module. One of the other biggest benefits of WSR is it's not just for web services. And, in fact, the majority of our customers are leveraging WSR for its MQ capabilities, governing MQ interfaces and message exchanges. And, effectively, I'm going to talk in terms of services and use that interchangeable with the interfaces for the MQ customers that are on the site, okay, on the conference. Policy enforcement, okay, it's very important to govern your policies alongside the services they are attached to. And as you'll see when we get into the governance enablement profile and what makes up a service version, it effectively, if you change a policy, you could be creating, well, you are creating a new version of a service, because a version of a service is more than the interface. It encompasses a wide range of things that make up a service version, and we'll get into that. And so this is why, you know, WSR, just for these are limited capabilities that I talk about. There's many more, but this is why WSR really becomes your enterprise SOL registry repository, because it hooks in and helps create that SOL visibility that I showed on the previous page. Now let's move on to slide 6. So what is this governance enablement profile? Well, it is a prescriptive profile that provides service consumer governance and service provider governance. Extremely important to have service consumer governance. Most people focus an extensive amount on service provider governance and forget about the very important consumer governance. And we're going to go into that again as soon as we get into the profile bit. The next it provides is service versioning and consumer versioning with that aspect as well. Endpoint management, contract management, this is that contract or service subscription between the consumer and provider, and integration with our Rational Asset Manager, which gives up the Rational, the WSR Advanced Lifecycle Edition. This really bridges you into that development time world where you can manage test cases, third-party jars, and all of the artifacts that actually make up that service, you know, the binaries that make up the services, the presentations, the architectural diagrams, the models, and things like that. So it gets, we have a very great linkages between the runtime and service lifecycle ask management all the way back into the development time. Moving on to chart 7. What is a profile? So we're talking about this governance enablement profile. Well, a profile is a packaging of all the configurations that make up the governance solution running inside WSR, okay? You create this or configure this package in WSR Studio, and you can deploy it directly to WSR, or you can export it as a zip file. So I'm going to talk in terms of the zip file. The things that are in this zip file or in this configuration are things like the metadata model. Okay, what is the metadata model that I'm going to, you know, of information that I'm going to capture? And we provide a pretty prescriptive approach to that. And I think 99% of our customers will leverage the base metadata model or leverage the base metadata model prescribed in the governance enablement profile. It defines set of life cycles, set of classifications, governance policies. These governance policies hold the integrity of the model, saying, you know, you need to have charter documents attached to a business capability before you can go to the next phase in the life cycle. So it adds some workflow, helps add some workflow and holds integrity. You define user roles and permissions and mappings in this configuration of validators, modifiers, and notifiers, and all of your UI customization are shipped in this configuration. As I said, it's exported as a zip file, and it can be imported into other WSR instances. This is a very big benefit to WSR, is this ability to generate and change your configuration, export it as a zip and import it into multiple WSR instances. And you can activate and deactivate these things on the fly. I call it hot pluggable. There are some caveats that you need to watch about out about, but you don't have to worry about any database drops or recreates or reinstallation of the product. It's a simple loading the profile up into the product when your governance process changes. For example, adding a property onto an existing entity because now you realize your governance process, you need another, to capture another bit of information. Okay, moving on to chart 8. Okay, chart 8. Now we're going to get into the fun stuff. This is the stuff that I really enjoy. It's the basics of the service, consumer, and provider governance, okay, and what that makes it up. Now, how I'm going to present this today doesn't, the model that you see coming down on the charts as we're building up, I don't deal with cardinality or whatever. We can go and you can look in WSR Studio for the correct cardinality and so forth on this. I'm just trying to get the ideas across of what it takes to govern, you know, both a service, consumer, and a provider, okay? And I'm going to talk in terms of the labels you will see inside that model. Okay, so first off, the first thing you need when you need basics of service governance is a business capability. Now, we all know WSRR's metadata model is based on OWL, okay, Web Ontology Language. The reason why this metadata is based on OWL is because it allows for extensions or simple inheritance. Now, a business capability in WSR is extended, and we provide it in the governance enablement profile. It's extended to represent a service. It can represent a process. It can represent an application. I've got customers that extend it and represent, get more specific and have it represent a port list. The whole purpose of this business capability, it does not contain technical information. It is the business reason why this function exists in the registry, okay? So I'm going to talk in terms of services today. So let's say I'm making an eligibility service. I am a business analyst or an architect, and I determine, you know what, we really need an eligibility service to determine the eligibility of a consumer to have to do something, okay, to create an account or open a have a loan, okay? It basically checks their eligibility. So what I do is I come to WSR, I create a service in this business capability, and I say, you know what, I need this eligibility service. It says this, it's going to, you know, satisfy this business requirement, and it's going to serve this function. And yeah, I typically describe this function in a Word document, and then we call it a charter. The main reason why this exists. And so we attach that or load that charter document up into WSR. Other things that you'll do in the business capability that has nothing to do with the technical aspects for why this exists is assign ownership. Well, who is going to own this service for our enterprise? Okay. And then the next thing is who is going to fund this service? And you're going to take this business capability and add metrics to it as you go to your center of excellence or architectural groups and decide. And then eventually you're going to say, you know what, this eligibility service is a true SOA service, so we're going to go ahead and create it. We're going to approve it. And so you approve, there's a life cycle around this, and you approve that you can begin development. The next aspect that you have then is, if you move to chart 9, we have the capability version. Now, this is where you really start to get into the functional characteristics of what the service version is. This is the technical aspects of it. Well, you typically attach like a service definition document here explaining what this version of the service is going to encompass. If it is a web service, you're going to attach things like a WSL interface to this capability version. You'll attach schema documents that represent this service, and you'll start attaching WS policy and any other technical artifact that helps represent what this service is and basically give the description so that when a consumer comes to the registry and is trying to view a service of what they want to use, they can see some of this information and policies around its use. the capability version has a life cycle, and we've described that in the info center for you. And we'll talk a little bit more about life cycles later. I'm going to the service interface specification is kind of an advanced topic. The interface specification really is when you're leveraging interfaces and through multiple different versions, the same interface through multiple different versions, or if you have an interface that's supplied to you by a third party and you're the one responsible for implementing or creating, filling out the specification in the service version capability. That's an advanced topic, and not a lot of our customers leverage that particular entity. And I would, if you're thinking about leveraging it, I would contact one of your IBM IT specialists and ask them about it and get in touch with one of us to help determine if that is an entity that you really need to use and govern in WSR. Because the whole point about governance is you need to keep it simple. If you don't keep it simple and you over-architect it, you're going to get so bogged down by governance, it's not going to be beneficial. So keep it simple. Now, the next entity I want to talk about is the service specification. Now, this is a very important entity in the fact of governing the schema life cycles. Your schemas will go through different life cycles. For example, if you're managing the Accord specification or any one of the industry standard schemas, you'll need to govern those and keep the life cycles of those and the relationships to the service versions that are going to be leveraging those. And you do that in the entity called schema specification. Okay, so now we've gotten all of the functional, we've talked about the functional aspects of the service version. Now let's go to slide 10 and talk about the non-functional aspects of the service version. This is called the service lifecycle definition. And again, this captures the non-functional characteristics, such as the service is required to be available 24/7. It has been certified to handle the max, max messages per day of 100,000 messages. It will have this response time, and all sorts of non-functional characteristics go in there. And really, the functional and non-functional characteristics make up the service version. Okay. Then after you've defined your non-functional characteristics, you've got your functional characteristics and your development team has begun develop and they've either decided to implement this as a web service or an MQ service or an EJB-based service. There's just many, or a RESTful-based REST service. The next thing we do is if you move on to chart 11, we have the what we call the service endpoint. And this endpoint will uphold the service level definition and the interface of the capability version, the functional aspects of things. And this has a life cycle as well, and it can be online or offline, okay? You take services endpoints online and take them offline and how you expose those. All right. Now we've kind of went through what a service provider governance, basics of how you go from having the idea of a service top down all the way down to the end point. The next thing we need to do is now govern the consumer. We'll talk about the service consumption. So I'm a consumer. I'm developing an account creation process, and I have an account creation service that needs to check the eligibility of a particular user to have an account created. Okay, so I go to the registry and I find the eligibility service, but I need to register my account creation service as well. So moving on to slide 12, guess what? I register my account creation service as I have to define a business capability for it. Okay, and I would if it was a portlet or an application coming to the registry to leverage this, I need to explain why I exist in the world and what my business function is in order to consume that. So, you know what? I register myself as in my case, I'm going to be in other service, because that's going to make for an interesting case when we get further along. So I'm an account creation service. Here's my charter document, why I exist. I'm owned by this organization. I'm funded by this organization. Moving on to slide 13. Guess what? I have a capability version. I specify my functional and my non-functional characteristics. If I'm exposed as a web service, I attach a WSL interface that describes my interface, any schema documents, any policy documents that are applied, and so forth. And now I request consumption because I want to use the eligibility service. So move on to slide 14. In the governance enablement profile, I can do this by creating what's called a document of understanding. And this represents really the high-level intent of using the eligibility service. It's an agreement, basically a statement of agreement of intent. So I create a DOU. It notifies the service provider, the eligibility service, hey, I would like to leverage your service. Here's the reasons why. And it goes back and forth, the discussion between the two, and eventually the document of understanding, the high level, is agreed upon between the two organizations. And so there's a life cycle around the document of understanding. Okay, the next bit, move on to slide 15. Now comes the service level agreement. Okay, so if you think of the DOU as a high level agreement between the two organizations, the service level agreement is really the operational aspects between the two. It gets into saying, well, I'm going to subscribe to that service level definition. I expect this service to be available 24/7. I myself, the consumer, am going to send you, out of the 100,000 transactions per day that you can accept with the service, I'm going to send you 50,000, okay? I expect a response time of X, Y, and Z, and so forth. Once the terms are agreed upon, it enters into an agreed upon state, and it sits there inactive. We have a life cycle around there that allows you to activate and inactivate a service level agreement. And this is because you might have the terms agreed to, but you might have to do some, the service provider may have to do something on the other end to ensure that they can uphold that service level agreement. For example, provisioning more hardware and able to meet that, because maybe this service eligibility service already has 3-4 other consumers and they're maxing out. Okay? So in order to bring this guy on, we can say, well, we're going to bring you on, but you can't come on until, send traffic to us until this date. Okay? And then once that date is met, the service level agreement can be activated and, you know, the traffic can be push through to the ESB. Now, to the service. Now, thinking about an ESB and how this gets into that, if you remember back to the two bubbles, right, we had the registry and the runtime overlapping. There's, for example, in WebSphere ESB, there is an SLA primitive check that you can put within your mediation flow, and you can capture when that request comes through the mediation, you can check to see if there is a consumer ID within that request. If there is a consumer ID within that request, you can double check that consumer ID with the service registry and check to make sure that they have a valid and active service level agreement. If not, you can have your mediation flow send a message back saying you don't have a active agreement in place, therefore you're not allowed, your application is not allowed to send requests to this service at this time. So this really helps you protect against that rogue consumer. Consumers hitting your service when you don't know it, which can affect your resources on your box and make you fail with other service level agreements. Now, that's an advanced topic in order to be able to enforce it. So at minimum, you may just want to start capturing the relationships between the service capability version and which service level definition they're applied to, and just at design time capture this, and then move into the enforcement bit as you get more mature. speaking about the ESBs as well, we have this service endpoint, back to the service endpoint. There's out-of-the-box mediations for all of our ESBs or primitives and all of our ESBs that allow you to drag this down onto your into your flow, and then you can configure it to dynamically go up and retrieve the endpoint. And you'd want to do this for several reasons. One, for operational concerns, right? Easing your operations. So it will reduce reduce operational expense as, you know, endpoints change. You don't have to worry about going in and changing mediations or configuration files. You can have that governed within the service registry and have the proper notifications sent out to those that are leveraging the services that this is going on. The other aspect, the more advanced aspect, is around selecting the appropriate service. Maybe you do have a couple different services, or the appropriate service version. For example, if you can change between 1.1 and 2.0. And then what another thing that folks leverage it for, you know, if you're changing between 1.0 and a 2.0, you might have to do a transform, and you can store that transformation in the registry as well and pull that down on your ESBs. Again, that's considered some of that configuration information. All right, so now we've got our consumer registered and has a proper service level agreement in place to use the eligibility service. But remember, I said I was account creation service. So we did functional characteristics. Now, guess what? Moving on to slide 16, I'm going to have non-functional characteristics. I'm going to define my own service level definition because I'm exposed as a service, right? And I'm going to have endpoints that uphold those, okay? So if you can think about this, my consumer is a service as in itself and can be consumed and will be consumed by the account creation process. Now, with WSR, this allows you to do an impact analysis and trace all the way through, okay? So it really gets to some interesting relationships as your SOA builds out and becomes more complex and you're leveraging reusing services, which are reusing services. Now, the other aspect that why it's important to govern your service consumer and provider is because, guess what? Services are going to have versions, right? And you're probably going to have at least two versions of a service in production at one time for a given period of time. Well, if your service is being consumed by another service or another application, that is going to have multiple versions in production at the same time. If you don't keep these relationships governed, you're not going to be able to know when you're going to be able to decommission and retire services and recover those resources. So it's very important. Now, capturing all this information, you might be scared that it's a lot, but you know what? All it needs to be at its basic level, it's just the representation of it in the registry. It can be as simple as just putting a couple clicks in there and putting the metadata, just simple pieces of metadata, a name, in order to capture this type of information. And you can get a huge benefit from just doing that simple ability, right? So you'll reduce your risks of you know, taking a service, decommissioning a service, when other critical applications are still relying on that. Moving on to slide 17. This is just, I just want to show you, this is kind of a bad picture, but when you bring up WSR Studio and you look at the governance enablement profiles model, this is what you'll see. And this basically has what I showed on the previous page, but in the more dealing with cardinality and showing some of the properties that come on that out of the box. And all you need to do is when you want to extend it, add properties, you right-click and add the properties, and then you generate the model, right-click and generate the model in order to import it. Obviously, I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's the basic step. Moving on to chart 18. We basically were going around the entities of the basic flow of service lifecycle governance. Now, along with those entities, each of those entities have life cycle states that they move through, okay? This helps indicate its progress in the development process, where, you know, where is each service version in the development process? Is it being deprecated? Is it in the retired state and so forth? Is the service online or offline? And all these life cycles are fully documented in the Info Center. Here's the caveat. We do not expect you to leverage these life cycles as is out of the box, okay? You're going to take a look at your development life cycle, your current development life cycle, and see where the appropriate gates make sense. Less life cycle states is better, okay? We provide all of those suggested life cycle states out of the box just to help you so that you can go in, drag, drop, and remove, and you don't have to try to think of the different life cycle states that you could possibly want. We provide those for you. You go in and change through WSR Studio, and we have a red book that helps you do that. Now, the next thing is that I want to talk about is the governance policy validator, which is used to enforce policies that apply to each of the transitions. Each of the state transitions can double check that certain items are present on that entity in order for it to move forward. For example, has an owning organization been applied to this business capability? If so, okay, then we can approve it. Is there a charter document available? If there's not a charter document, we can't approve it because nobody knows what this thing is about, right? We need to do the due diligence of writing the one paragraph or two paragraphs that explain what this service is for and intended to, so that you can, you know, keep a track and make sure you're marching, that service is marching down the correct path. Okay. The other thing the governance policy validator does is to help decide who or what role can actually transition a particular object from one state to another, whether another object is related to another object and so forth. For example, maybe there needs to be a schema specification attached before you can approve a service version, if that is a requirement in your development process and how you develop your services. Let's move on to slide 19. So this gets into the life cycles a little bit more detail. There's 8 different life cycles that ship as part of the governance enablement profile that you can take a look at. And I give a little explanation, which you can read here, but the Info Center has more. And better yet, we have a red book called Service Lifecycle Governance with WSR that takes an in-depth look and makes some suggestions if you don't know where to start on how to simplify the life cycles, and actually walks you step-by-step through doing that simplified state. Moving on to slide 20. And here's an example of the business capability life cycle. This life cycle is pretty, when I go to customers, this is pretty much the life cycle they do use, so for the business capability. When you create the entity, it automatically goes into the identified state. When you started filling out, you know, the description or attach the charter of the service and you're ready to expose it and let other people know about the idea behind this service, you can move it into a charter review. Emails go out and folks come to the registry to review the document. After the review of it and going with your architectural teams, you move it into the approved state. And then eventually you'll deprecate the service when you no longer need it or it's evolved so much. Okay, moving on to slide 21. This is just a screenshot to show the WSR business services and show the service reuse graph so that you can, capturing this information in WSR allows you to really gain visibility. How am I doing for service reuse? Is any of my services being reused? Is anybody capturing this information? For example, I have 8 services registered that the big green area that have 0 consumers. Why is that? Why don't I have any consumers? Are those services still under development? Or do I have a lot of rogue consumers out there, and I need to get control over that so I can understand the resources and the operational needs of that service? I've got one service that has 2 consumers. That's great. And another service with three services with one consumer. I was talking to another customer the other day on reuse, and they're like the poster children for SOA, and they have right now about 150 true services that run this whole financial organization. And I asked, well, how much reuse are you getting out of those 150 services? And they said that they have quite a few services that have 10 consumers, right? And they spell to see this on this graph. And you can take that information and champion it back up. If you're from the technical folks, you want to champion that back up to your manager and say, look, we're being successful here. You know, we need to further our investment in this way, and then your managers can champion up to their executives on the business impact that you're doing. Moving on to chart 22, this slide basically shows the policy analytics. As you develop out your governance process, you're going to be you're going to check to see that the policies that devise your governance policies are being enforced. You want to come here and you're going to check how well your governance process is working. Are the policies that you put in place in the registry hindering your ability to effectively execute as a team? So then you need to go and change your governance policies so that you can be more effective. Or are you failing policies because your team doesn't understand the value of that policy? Well, then you can start doing lunch and learn and help them, educate them on the need and why you would want to comply to this policy that you have enforced in your governance process. Or maybe they don't know how to comply to this. And then, again, it's an educational fit. And then as your company grows, your SOA initiative grows, your what you need to govern is going to change as well. And so this analytics kind of gives you a heads up when you should start looking at your governance process and doing some tweaking. Moving on to slide 23. Slide 23 is WSR Studio. You put all this information inside the registry and repository. What you need to do is generate reports. Again, they are so important to champion back up to your executives and your SOA about what's going on. And there's an excellent red paper that is coming out. Well, it's out on draft right now that has a series of reports that you can take and leverage with the governance enablement profile. So you can have some right reports right out of the box to help start champion your SOA. And you can tweak the reports as you change your governance model and so forth. But at least it gives you a place, an idea of what type of information would people want to understand of what's going on in your SOA. Moving on to slide 24. The slide 24, this is the IBM Red Books and Red Papers that I would suggest reading to help you champion and set out your SOA. The first one is the Service Lifecycle Governance using the WebSphere Service Registry Repository. It'll go over and give you more detail on what I went over today. It'll tell you how to change your life cycles, and it'll give you a profile, a simplified life cycle profile out of the box if you don't want to generate it yourself. It's a great book. The next bit is if you're going and extending beyond service lifecycle management integration with a runtime, and you want to start gathering and managing those development assets as well, and architectural and so forth, it gets into the WSR Advanced Lifecycle Edition, which is product bundling of the WSR and Rational Asset Manager. And that's a great book to read. For any additional information, we've got DeveloperWorks articles on anything under the sun and all of those use cases that I mentioned for WSR. Remember the three bubbles? We've got articles on those. You can go to the WSR information portal, which is located off of DeveloperWorks, and it'll point you to the right places to go. Moving on to slide 25. So what we've covered today is we went over a little bit of the difference between SOA governance and service governance, the elements of a SOA platform, those three bubbles that I talked about, actually. We went into, you know, service governance with WSR. I gave you a very brief overview of some of the key capabilities WSR has. If you want any more, just feel free to send me an email, and I can give you more information if you weren't very familiar of all the capabilities of WSR. We went into the governance enablement profile, and we went into a deep dive of that profile. Move on to slide 25, and we're almost going to be ready to open it up for questions after we get through with this chart. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange web conferences like this one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks, as I mentioned before, offers in-depth technical information. Visit the WebSphereUserGroup.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up and the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notification link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly emails updates for products of interest to you. So with that, I'm going to open it up for questions.
Once again, press star 1 to ask a question. We have a question from Fu Yan Yao. Your line is open.
Oh, yeah. I got a question. The question I have is in the SLA detail view, there's a field called context identifier. Not sure what's that used for, like who is actually who is going to be identified, you know, that field.
Was that in the SLA? There's the context identifier?
Yeah.
So, for example, the application, the consumer,
okay,
might have many different, could have different service level agreements.
Okay.
And so it helps provide the context of the service level agreement. So it's kind of used in conjunction with the consumer ID.
So that one actually identifies the consumer, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So another one is like similar to this. This is the one in the service version. There's a consumer ID.
Yes. So there's the consumer ID that identifies the consumer, but the consumer will have many different could have many different service level agreements.
Okay.
In the registry, and the context ID specifically isolates that particular service level agreement.
Okay, so there's a little bit confusing here because we have a provider and a consumer. So consumer has that service version. As a consumer, I can put my consumer ID. So it means actually to identify myself as a consumer. Is that right?
Right. So typically, when you're developing that capability, if it's a service or application or
okay,
whatever it is, I've seen customers use a project ID for that service version or some number to uniquely or number or letter combination to uniquely identify that particular version of the capability, you know, the service, the application or what have you. Then when you create a service level agreement, you may reuse that consumer ID, or if you need to have more context for that service level agreement, that's why you have the context ID in there.
Okay, so let me to understand. That consumer ID, I think my understanding is that consumer ID is identify myself as a consumer. So in SLA, that's actually in the provider side, because the provider is going to specify SLD. Inside the SLAD, I'm going to it has a SLA. So in that SLA, it actually specifies this context ID, actually specifies the consumer. So the context ID, my understanding is that from provider side to specify the consumer,
How you generate that consumer ID, it depends on how your governance process is set up. But basically, it allows you to uniquely identify that service level agreement.
Yeah, I know. But who's going to identify who? This is very confusing.
So for example, when the request comes in, so that context ID, right? The consumer would insert that context ID or context ID and consumer ID inside their request header for web service.
You have two things. You have a consumer ID request from a consumer, right? You have a consumer ID that's going to identify myself. So you have a context ID. Who is that identify?
That identifies that contract, that service level agreement between the consumer and the provider. It identifies that service level agreement, which you can hook up to that consumer. It depends on how you want to gather that service level agreement. It adds an extra level of context to the flow if you need it.
Oh, I think I kind of get it. So this context ID actually, it's just nothing to do with consumer or provider. It just identifies that object.
It helps. It gives the context to that service level agreement. Yes.
Yeah. Since computer, because you have this field for consumer ID, but you don't have anything for provider ID, so that's kind
well,
of...
Well, the provider ID is basically, if the provider, the consumer is the one sending the request in, and so it needs to identify itself when coming through the ESP. If you're going to enforce it, it identifies itself so that your ESP or your mediation or your proxy can take that consumer ID and context ID out of the header, use those two things to look up to find the service level agreement. And from the service level agreement, if you look at the model, you can easily find which service level definition it's applied to, and you can grab and get the service endpoints from there. So you know who the provider is. It's a way for the consumer to identify itself and the service level agreement, which allows them to invoke this service. Now, remember, the service provider can also be a service consumer. So the service provider will have, on the service version, has the context ID. So that is the service provider's ID as well.
Oh, asking a question. Yeah. Thanks a lot. I think that's a little bit clear.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question goes from Guillermo Moreno.
I just get this little doubt. What DOU stands for?
It stands for Document of Understanding, and it really helps with the linkages with the Rational Asset Manager, which deals more with the development process and creating documents of understanding between two organizations to leverage or use each other's components. Right.
Okay.
So it's basically a high level agreement. It's not until you get down to the service level agreement where you actually get the contract between the service consumer and the provider, the operational aspect.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The next question comes from Harsha Garam.
I wanted to know how WSSR can be used with MQ and what governing features are available with respect to MQ.
Which learning features? We have a couple of DeveloperWorks articles, which you can find off of that WebSphere information portal on the MQ support. So with the WSR's MQ support, there's a specification that allows you to describe MQ services in WSDL. So MQ Explorer 7 also has a wizard to help you do that, right? And so you can either do that manually or use the MQ Wizard to help you do that, to describe them as WSDL, and then you can import that WSDL up into WSR, and WSR will parse that WSDL and create the respective MQ endpoint. Okay, now that's one way to support. So that's the one way it supports WSDL, right? And it'll break out the endpoints described in WSDL, you know, describe the queue managers, connect managers, and the queues, okay? That's one way that WSR, it helps, right? And you can do an impact analysis and see how the queues and queue managers and so forth and messages relate to each other. The other way, we provide a metadata model. If you don't want to describe your MQ services as WSDL, we provide a metadata model out of the box that allows you to describe and enter and manage your queues and queue managers and all of the information that you need to about MQ services. Okay? Then if you go to our ESVs like broker, the endpoint lookup node can determine and pull down, can leverage and take and route to the appropriate queues. If you want to leverage that with message broker.
Oh, okay. Can we do runtime monitoring of this MQ? Runtime management of MQ. So, for example, if we want to track how many messages have been flown from the queues and whether any channels are down and all, something like governance of the MQ.
I believe there is an IT Camp or SOA product that does manage the and views the MQs. I don't know that right offhand, the exact product.
Okay, fine. Thanks for answering me.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Satish Gadam.
Hey, this is Satish. I have a quick question. Can I run runtime and the governance in the same cell?
So if you want to spur up a runtime instance, server instance of WSR on the same cell as WSR governance instance,
yes.
I believe we only support running one WSR instance in a single cell at this time.
Okay.
So
you can
have multiple, if you're talking about a system, you can have multiple WSR instances running on the same hardware, but they cannot be in the same cell.
Oh, okay. Is there any requirement in future to run on same server, same cell? Like, is it?
I do not know of any requirements this day to run them in the same cell. If you'd like to, you can surely submit that requirement.
All right, okay. Thank you.
Yep.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Danielle. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.